that's true. I think probably his wife was quite an inspiration at first, but she became the sort of the taskmaster. And he, Elgar was always a flirtatious man. I think that's what one can deduce from the way that his life worked out. He had this muse, is putting it perhaps at its most polite. This lady who was the wife of a Conservative MP, Alice Stewart Wortley, who he'd met in the 1900s socially, and then she became a real, I think it's probably not too strong to say, a flame for him. At the end of that first decade of the 20th century, when he was writing the violin concerto, and he'd got really stuck and was on the point of abandoning it, when he, I think they had tea, and he got inspired by her and called her Windflower as her nickname. And this was a lifelong friendship. His wife knew all about it. They sometimes socialized together. But there was clearly a sort of private language going on between them. And the interesting thing is that her letters, fortunately, her letters to him survive, although some of them have been cut, you know, been bits of it cut out with scissors, I think by Windflower's daughter, who felt they were too embarrassing to survive. But none of Windflower's letters to Elgar survive, or hardly any. And this is interesting because he kept everything meticulously. But those letters he destroyed, and that, one presumes, is because it was a bit more than an inspiration.
So we have a portrait of somebody who is full of contradictions, somebody who is respectably married, looking to have a position in a society, this Elgar we know, and who has a kind of deeply romantic undersized side that he's keeping secret, if not repressing. He's come from a very ordinary background. He's a violin teacher, and now he's a knight of the realm. He's immensely successful, and he's very proud of it. Is this the origin of this kind of irony, the edginess in his music that you've started to talk about? Or is there a kind of inner psychic core to it?
The music is full of that, even in some of the most sort of tub-thumping tunes. The Land of Hope and Glory has a sort of pull between major and minor, which is really intriguing. And it's not, you know, there's a sadness to it and a poignancy. And that is the key, of course, to understand. You're on the edge the whole time with Elgar. And that's what I think we've come to understand with his music in the last 20 years or so. Maybe it was understood in his own lifetime, towards the latter period of his life. People said that he was, that there was a mask there and he wasn't revealing his true self. But in between, we've been beguiled by his own image.
Because there's a distinct decline in his life. Simon, will you read us Rosa Burley's account from 1920, when his wife dies after 30 years of marriage. And here's some Rosa Burley's account of it.
Oh, there's no doubt that her death, after 31 years of their married life, came as an overwhelming blow to him. But it was not in precisely the kind of blow which had been described by most of his biographers. That Alice had devoted her whole life to Edward is beyond question. She really did worship him, with a blindness to his faults, and indeed to his occasional cruelty to her, that seemed almost incredible. But it's equally true that, while relying on this devotion, he was in the first place rather impatient of its blindness, and in the second, uncomfortably guilty over his debt to it. Her death accentuated this conflict in his soul, and left him completely stunned. He had not the largeness of mind which enabled Disraeli to overlook the faults of understanding of the woman whose fortune had established him. The marriage had been in many ways irksome and irritating. Many of the friends whose wealth had dazzled Edward in the later years had barely concealed their contempt for Alice. But Alice's extremely conventional standards of correct conduct had already made an indelible impression on him. And throughout his married life, he had been at immense pains to maintain a facade of married bliss. I have few memories of Edward after this point. It was odd, after nearly 30 years of intimate friendship, to meet him face to face, as often happened at festivals. and to find that I was completely ignored. I can only guess that an overmastering sense of guilt towards Alice led him to shun the society of those who'd been allowed to look behind the facade of happiness, and who were thus regarded as having, in some measure, connived in his disloyalty to her.
Thank you, Simon. Now we're in a later phase. Elgar's music has dropped out of favour, quite quickly, actually, after the First World War, and he'd become already the embodiment of a kind of jingoistic, nationalistic, imperial past. And even as an English composer, English in a slightly depressing way, he wasn't those things. You've already explained that he wasn't these things. But if not, why was he so persistently misread and misheard?
Oh, because of his... He wanted that to be the image, and it was a sort of rope that he put around his own neck. And I think that he began to sort of, I suppose, as he got older, he began to lament the passing of his time, and he knew that he didn't belong in the 1920s. And it was only in the 1930s when another woman comes along that he starts to recover himself.
Well, that's right, isn't it? Vera Hockman. Simon, would you read us the letter she wrote to him after his death?
Robin Hill, June the 2nd, 1934. My wondrous being. It would seem strange and unnatural when so many have written their reminiscences, appreciations, eulogies of you. And how many have claimed an intimate knowledge of you when they have known only the reserved exterior, that I, who have loved you best of all, have been silent for all these tragic months. The reason why is obvious to you and me. The thoughts and memories I cherish of you are far too intimate, too expressibly dear to me, to be told to any but our nearest and dearest. Supposing somebody asked me, what was there about Elgar that made his personality so unique, even when in contact with those unaware of the grandeur and magnitude of his creative work? I should reply, he was the only person I have known who was absolutely natural in all his actions, spontaneous and grand and glorious in his supreme egotism. For you were the most self-engrossed, self-enamored person imaginable. Yet you loved yourself in such a lovable way that instead of turning others away from you, your love of yourself was contagious. No wonder you were in love with your brilliant, dazzling self. Ain't I clever? You were too big to trouble to disguise from those for whom you had any genuine regard your admiration of your own stupendous brain, imagination, memory, genius. Any pose of modesty was for the ununderstanding masses. Yes, you were so self-centered that even your kindly acts were often frankly and unaffectedly a form of self-gratification. But you were so dependent on sympathy and understanding and appreciation, that this dependence aroused in one the protective instinct and a sort of tender compassion that anyone so gigantic in intellect should be so childishly dependent on everyday mortals.
Thank you, Simon. John, one more woman on Elgar's personal holocaust, or different? I mean, this is an extraordinary letter. She has a startling knowledge of him and their relationship.
Incredibly,
who was she?
Incredibly penetrating. I mean, what devastating and yet beautiful, sort of tender as well. I mean, she was a violinist. That he was conducting a performance of The Dream of Gerontius, and he'd spotted her in the second violins in this performance, and he asked the leader of the orchestra to introduce him to this lady. So she was sort of brought, after the concert, she was brought so that he could meet her. And he said, I couldn't take my eyes off you. And he said that to her, you know, at their first meeting. I think absolutely incredible. It shows the sort of flirtatious man that he was. Of course, by then, he'd been widowed for 12 years, something like that. But some biographers, I think, have made the mistake of thinking this was just a little flirtatious behavior and that she was a sort of flibbity gibbet. Well, she was far from that. You can tell from that letter.
When Elgar was dying, He was actually working on a third symphony, which he didn't finish. But from listening to what there is of it, do you think it's merely fanciful to say that he was working towards some kind of resolution that was enabled by this relationship?
I certainly think that the symphony was inspired by the relationship. It was energized. I'm not saying that he thought, oh, now I'll write a third symphony. He was commissioned by the BBC, as it happens, to write the third symphony. But I think it gave him the energy and the confidence, perhaps feeling that, you know, this young, attractive woman was mesmerized by him in that very knowing way. She knew exactly what sort of character he was. But it's all the things she's talking about, the fact that he needed this, he was dependent on that sort of affection. And I think if he'd only lived another few months with that cancer, he would have completed the symphony.
Thank you very much, John Bridcutt, Simon Woods.
Susan Hitch presented this evening's Proms Plus literary event at the Royal College of Music. The producer was Gavin Hurd. Well, welcome back up those steps to the Royal Albert Hall from me, Martin Handley. And after those readings about Edward Elgar and talk about him, the one work on the programme in the second half of this first BBC Prom of the evening, given by the BBC Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Martin Brabbins, is Elgar's First Symphony.
It is a towering masterpiece. I mean, it may be the greatest symphony by a British composer. And when you say that, it's not a light statement, because British composers wrote some fantastic symphonies in the 20th century, you know, the Vaughan Williams, Walton. I think Mahler and Strauss have a big similarity with Elgar's treatment of the orchestra, his orchestration. Some people say that Elgar's a finer orchestrator than both of them, but they all have an extraordinarily refined ear for colour, and that I think is one of the real strengths of this music. You hear sounds, combinations of instruments that one can't imagine, but Elgar did imagine, and I think that puts him on a really high level of incredible inspiration and craftsmanship.
It's a work about which Hans Richter said to the London Symphony Orchestra when preparing the first London performance a century ago, "Gentlemen, now let us rehearse the greatest symphony of modern times, written by the greatest modern composer, and not only in this country." Elgar was 50 when he wrote it. It was Richter who'd given him the idea and to whom he dedicated it as a true artist and true friend. If you compare the symphony with, say, Mahler's Seventh and listen to the more abrasive and personally expressive moments in Elgar's work, which he deliberately opposed to the noble theme which dominates the symphony, he seems perhaps surprisingly close to the cutting edge of the avant-garde of his time. All the more remarkable then that it made it an immediately triumphal progress around the world with 100 performances in its first year of life. In Britain, the stability and security of the British Empire, which had been a given for decades, was seen to be beginning to fray around the edges. People were becoming uneasy at what the future might hold, and Elgar, with his sensitive artist's antenna, was reminding people just what Edwardian England had to lose. The composer himself said of his symphony, "There is no programme beyond a wide experience of human life with a great charity or love and a massive hope in the future." Whatever he was driving at, audiences clearly understood the resonances. The symphony's in four movements, with the second, a scherzo, and the following slow movement played without a break. And tonight, looking at the platform, well, we have that row of 8 double basses, Vienna Philharmonic style, at the back of the platform, facing out into the auditorium. According to Martin Brabbins, that was how Bolt liked to do it, and indeed Elgar himself. So those of you trying to visualise it, it's the double basses right at the back under the bust of Sir Henry, and the organ with the horns next to them and the percussion. And below them is the timpani and the lower wind, clarinets, bassoons, trumpets, trombones and tuba, just the flutes and oboes on the lowest of the little risers, and then on the floor, of course, the strings divided violins, first and second, opposing one another. And back comes Martin Brabbins onto the platform here at the Royal Albert Hall to conduct the BBC Symphony Orchestra in Elgar's First Symphony.
Thank you.
Elgar wrote to a friend in May 1907, "I shall be 50 next week, so they tell me, but I don't know it. I have my pipe and my bicycle and a heavenly country to ride in. I take no interest whatsoever in music." Within weeks, though, he was at work on the work we've just heard here in the Royal Albert Hall, his first symphony in this BBC Proms performance live on Radio 3, given by the BBC Symphony Orchestra, led by Anna Coleman and conducted by Martin Brabbins. First performed at the Proms 103 years ago, conducted, of course, by Sir Henry Wood. Also on the programme that night, Grieg's Piano Concerto with Percy Grainger, a soloist. I wonder what that sounded like. Martin Brabbins back on the platform, bringing the orchestra to its feet. Irresistible journey, Martin Brabbins called it, that symphony. Well, Richter said it was the greatest symphony in modern times, written by the greatest modern composer, not only in this country. Could be justified in part by the circumstances. As the writer Michael Kennedy has remarked, this was not only Elgar's first symphony, it was England's. BBC Symphony Orchestra will be back here. Something rather different. Philip Glass's Nixon in China. Well, no, Nixon in China anyway. On the 5th of September, conducted by John Adams. Great cast. For Martin Brabbins, who is just coming back onto the platform, looking still very chipper. He's taking Elgar One in his case with him to Adelaide at the weekend. That and Tchaikovsky, and he's looking forward very much to a new production of Vaughan Williams' Pilgrim's Progress at English National Opera in the autumn. Brings the BBC Symphony Orchestra to its feet. Well, that symphony spoke to its first Edwardian audience, and as you can hear, it still does to this 21st century one here in the Royal Albert Hall. Just something about Elgar which is greater than the sum of its parts. From an uplifted Albert Hall, time for me to hand you on to Jonathan Swain at Broadcasting House for a little downtime here on Radio 3 before we return to the big round building in South Kensington. Jonathan.
Martin, thank you very much. Martin Handley there at the Royal Albert Hall. And as he intimated, we're back at the hall for our next prom in, well, just over an hour's time. Our late night prom brings Eric Whittaker to the Albert Hall as conductor of his own beautifully crafted choral music. There'll also be pieces by Leonard Bernstein on the programme, among others. And add the sound of the 48-voice combined choirs with the Albert Hall acoustics, and it should be something of a choral feast of a concert. That's our late night prom, live here on BBC Radio 3 at 10:15. As for tomorrow and Friday...
On Radio 3 from the BBC Proms, Sir Simon Rattle and the Berlin Philharmonic. Two consecutive evenings from this most celebrated of musical partnerships, starting with a programme that includes the suite from Ravel's Daphnis and Chloe and Debussy's Je, and in the following night's concert, the exhilarating second piano concerto by Brahms. The Berlin Philharmonic at the BBC Proms, starting tomorrow night at 7:30 on BBC Radio 3.
And the Berlin Philharmonic prom tomorrow night starts off with Ligeti's Slowly Shifting Sound Clouds Atmosphere. One of the late night proms a couple of weeks or so ago set off with Ligeti's Poème Symphonique for 100 metronomes. Well, this, like Atmosphere, is a Ligeti piece for more conventional musical instruments, his 6 bagatelles for wind quintet. They're from Ligeti's Hungarian period, in other words, before he went to live in Vienna in 1956. And in the main, they're quick-witted virtuoso aphorisms. Some of them, though, strike deeper. The 5th bagatelle is, in fact, an elegy for Bartok. The players are London Winds.
Thank you. Thank you.
Music by George Ligeti, and Capricious was the marking he gave to the last of those six bagatelles, all of them, though, such personalities. They're arrangements Ligeti made in 1956 from some of his earlier piano pieces. The players there, London Winds. And, as I mentioned, Ligeti's Atmosphere launches the first of the Berlin Philharmonic's proms tomorrow night, a prom which also includes Debussy's ballet Je. And before tonight's feature at 9:30, one of the Debussy preludes for piano, The Wind in the Plain Holds Its Breath. Le Vent dans la Plaine, the third of Debussy's Book One Preludes, played there by Stephen Osborne. You're listening to BBC Radio 3, it's just gone 9:30, and now in a programme first broadcast last December, Linda Presley explores the life of one of Cuba's most influential revolutionary women. Celia Sanchez joined the movement against the dictatorship of Batista in the early 1950s. In 1957, she met Fidel Castro and became his indispensable aide. Very little's been written about the role she played in Cuba until her death in 1980. So Linda Presley goes in search of Celia Sanchez.
We are in the cemetery Cristóbal Colón, which is in Havana. It's one of the largest cemeteries all over Latin America.
Andrés Corioso is one of the official guides at the cemetery.
It is huge. It covers 138 acres.
Tell me about Celia Sanchez. When Celia Sanchez died in January 1980, tell me about her funeral.
This was one of the biggest funerals ever here in Cuba. and she's buried here in the Armed Forces Memorial. This is the place where the most important person from our government had buried.
And you say it was one of the biggest funerals. So how many people came? Do you know? I mean, you were a little boy then, but...
yes, I was a little boy at that time, but I've been told thousands of people were present here, including Fidel, Raul, and
all the ministers.
Wife. Yes, all the ministers. This is it.
So it's in a whole bank of marble tombs.
Yes.
Celia is one in the middle.
In the middle, in the number 43. As you can see here, there's a bunch of flowers.
The last time I came to Havana and I visited this cemetery, there were fresh flowers. I think I came twice during that visit, and there were fresh flowers there on her grave then.
Because it's not common to bring flowers. People come here to worship her because she was so deeply beloved.
But it's to worship her or it's just to remember her?
To remember, to worship her and to thank her because she solved a lot of problems. She helped women. They had kids and they had no husband. And also she became the godmother of orphan kids, those whose father had died in the struggle against Batista.
Celia Sanchez, godmother, crusader against injustice, committed with every fibre of her being to the revolution led by Fidel Castro. All of this is true in Cuba. But this is Cuba. And every detail, every nuance of its revolutionary history is contested territory. The battle lines were drawn over 50 years ago. On one side, loyalists on the island. On the other, the anti-Castro exile community with its centre of gravity in Florida. Dr. Andy Gomez is a senior fellow at the Institute for Cuban and Cuban-American Studies at the University of Miami.
I think Fidel Castro, first and foremost, wanted power. And I think Celia was on the same side of that.
So Celia wanted to keep him there?
Celia wanted to keep him there, and she would do anything to keep him there. Celia truly believed anybody that would challenge Fidel's power needed to be eliminated.
And that was about her relationship with Fidel, or it was about what she wanted for Cuba?
No, that was the relationship with Fidel first, and I would say second, what she wanted for Cuba.
For many exiles, Celia Sanchez is defined not by her own political ideals, but by her relationship with Cuba's former leader, a relationship often assumed to be sexual. Officially, Celia Sanchez was secretary to the president. But from the moment she met Fidel Castro in the struggle against the dictatorship of Fulgencio Batista in 1957, they were virtually inseparable, their destinies intertwined.
The history of Fidel Castro as a major political and military leader cannot be explained, cannot be understood without the key contributions made by Celia Sanchez during the first 25 years of the Cuban Revolution.
Domingo Amuchastegui left Cuba for Miami in 1993 after more than 3 decades working for the Castro government. He's therefore someone who wouldn't be trusted by hardliners on either side of the Florida Straits. But his analysis of Celia's role isn't contentious. So if she was so important, why do we know so little about Celia Sanchez? She certainly came as a surprise to me. As I trawled the revolutionary tourist circuit on my first trip to Havana 20 years ago, I don't remember any trace of her. A decade later, when I returned, someone mentioned Celia Sanchez in passing. Who? I said. Bookshelves groan with endless weighty biographies of Fidel Castro and, of course, Che Guevara. There are detailed accounts of their ideologies, policies and relationships. On Celia Sanchez, there's virtually nothing. And as Dr. Tiffany Sipiel, a professor of history at Auburn University in Alabama, found out, inside Cuba, there are significant obstacles to researching this precious national icon.
Celia Sanchez, she didn't leave a lot of the documentary evidence that we as historians look for, so there's no diary that we know of unless it appears later. But the other obstacles are, of course, that Castro hasn't come out publicly and spoken at any great length about her significance or his relationship to her, all of these burning questions that we have. And so you get a kind of, I hate to say this, but it is a kind of scripted narrative about her that she was the mother of the Cuban Revolution, the heart of the revolution, that she played a significant role, but she was always sort of always off stage. That was frustrating. I wanted to get more into the particulars of what her contributions were.
And what's your analysis about why Fidel Castro hasn't spoken about her in the way that he perhaps might have spoken about other revolutionary figures?
Yeah, it's interesting that he seems to be very protective of her memory. I really can't imagine why he hasn't wanted to come out and say more, but he's very close-lipped about it and apparently only speaks about her to his brother and his really inside circle.
So who was this small, dark-haired woman with intense black eyes at the heart of the revolution? How far did she shape Cuban history and policy? And what was the nature of her relationship with El Máximo leader Fidel Castro? My journey began in Oriente, Cuba's tropical east.
Celia Sanchez was born in the sugar town of Media Luna. Her father was the only doctor here in those days, and he and his large family lived in a house on the main street, now preserved as a museum dedicated to the work and life of Celia Sanchez. If you stand on the main street just outside the house where she was born and look up the road, you can see the sugar factory that was built by the British and now disused. This was a very poor town in the early 20th century, and Dr. Sanchez, Celia's dad, had a reputation as being a very fair and honest man and would treat anybody who appeared at his door.
Celia's mother died when she was small, and she was brought up in a family of six sisters and two brothers.
El arma del Dr. Sanchez, la pistola Col 45.
Maritza Acuña Núñez, the director of the Celia Sanchez Museum, shows me the handgun Dr. Sanchez gave to Celia when she joined the rebel movement.
Que hubo una gran afinidad entre él y Celia.
Dr. Sanchez and Celia get along very well. They were always together when she was here at home with her family.
Because he ran for election, didn't he?
Sí, él incursionó en la política.
He was involved in politics, but he was frustrated because he saw that all the politicians in the country never respond to the interests of the people. He always supported his daughter as a fighter for the freedom of our country.
So did Celia get her politics from her father then, do you think?
Sí, definitivamente sí.
Celia learned from him every thought of this revolutionary process. He taught her the pain of others. Dr. Sanchez taught all his children to have no social or racial prejudice.
The beach where Celia Sanchez spent many happy childhood hours is deserted on a Thursday afternoon. Out to the bay, the fishermen's boats, very simple, made of wood, are bobbing in the sunlight. And behind me, a cafe with four or five workers in it, just sitting, enjoying the sounds because there's nobody here to buy the coffee.
Celia era muy audaz.
Celia was a very good swimmer. She loved to swim and she loved to go in the boats. And she organized among her sisters and brothers synchronized swimming competitions.
So this area now, I mean, it's quite a run-down little beach. But Celia used to come here as a teenager because here there was Club Náutica.
Existían dos clubes.
There were two different clubs. The club where Celia used to come was for the middle class, and there used to be another club where everyone were allowed to go to there, Club Jicotea.
Uh-huh. So black people wouldn't have been allowed in this club then?
Black people were not allowed to go in the Club Náutica, but there are stories that tell us that Celia was seen frequently in the club Jicotea.
And what kind of music did she like?
Bueno, fundamentalmente música cubana.
Celia Sanchez would play this traditional organ music from Oriente during official receptions in Havana once Fidel was in power. But that was still years away. In 1940, she moved with her family to Pilon, a remote community. As her brothers and sisters left home, she took charge of the housekeeping and assisted Dr. Sanchez. The biography of her, sanctioned by the Cuban government, records several love affairs and a passion for flowers and plants. She also discovered the writings of José Martí,
the champion of independence who died fighting the Spanish. And, like her father, she became politically active in the Orthodox Party. Uba Matos, a teacher then, was the only person I'd talked to who'd known Celia in the 1940s, when she was still in her 20s.
She was a very disciplined woman, very civic-minded, concerned about the country. Celia was a Catholic woman, but she was also interested in African cults, the Santeria religion. She was patriotic, worried about Cuba, which was still a young republic.
Uba Matos, now 92, clearly liked and respected Celia Sanchez. But today he lives in exile. In Cuba, he's a disgraced former comandante who betrayed the revolution and served 20 years in prison for treason and sedition. In Miami, he's a hero who dared to confront Fidel Castro. But I'm getting ahead of myself.
El General Batista, ante los micrófonos de todas las emisoras del país. Arriba, silencio.
Hablo al pueblo de Cuba.
In 1952, Fulgencio Batista, who'd been president in the 1940s, seized power again in a coup.
Para el progreso y la democracia, la libertad y la justicia.
Cuando surgió el golpe de Estado, ella dijo a Batista...
When the coup happened and Batista took over, Celia said, "We have to bring him down with bullets." She thought we should rise up and use violence to overthrow him. And I, too, was convinced that sooner or later, the only way to get rid of Batista was through violence.
Celia Sanchez began to organize against Batista.
This is the oldest cemetery of Cuba.
And with who, tell me, do I have the pleasure of talking in the cemetery in Santiago?
José, the historian of the cemetery Santa Ifigenia. When you talk about history, can be considered the most important cemetery of Cuba because José Martí, our national hero, he is resting here since June 30, 1951.
The remains of José Martí, the revered hero of Celia Sanchez and millions of Cubans, on the island, in exile, whatever their politics, are housed in an impressive memorial.
So this is the tomb...
of José Martí. Inside there is a coffer with the remains of José Martí. Sorry, we have to go downstairs.
What's happening now?
The changing of the guard.
Changing of the guard?
Every half an hour there is a changing of the guard.
The rookie military recruits stamp their shiny boots in a dramatic goose step. This elaborate ceremony has only been in place since 2002, but no doubt Celia Sanchez would have approved. José Martí has no rival in the pantheon of Cuban martyrs.
And Celia Sanchez, she and her friends, they did a guard of honor here in
1953. She came together with the three friends. They do the guard of honor around the tomb, and they stayed here in the cemetery till night on his anniversary, because we are talking about 1953. They wanted to honor him during his centenary.
And why would young people like Celia Sanchez have been so enamored, so taken with José Martí?
The ideals, the independence, the freedom, you know? We can say that we were really independent January the 1st, 1959.
And before that?
All the governments were responding to the interests of the United States.
José Martí, he didn't trust the United States.
He didn't trust on the United States. He didn't want to be under the control of them, you know?
And those ideas were taken by people like Celia, by Fidel?
By Che Guevara also, you know?
So Celia Sanchez was here in 1953 doing the Guard of Honor.
Yes.
Meanwhile, in Havana, Fidel Castro is preparing the attack on the Moncada barracks here.
Yeah, yes.
Which many people say started the revolution, really.
Yeah.
On the 26th of July, 1953, Fidel Castro made his first attempt to overthrow Batista. In an audacious but doomed assault, he and over 100 followers attacked the Moncada barracks in Santiago. Dozens were captured by Batista's troops, tortured and killed. Fidel Castro was lucky to escape with his life. He was imprisoned and, says Uba Matos, became a hero.
Fidel became the national leader, the answer to Batista. Cubans applauded him as the leader capable of directing the fight against Batista because of what he'd done at Moncada. And Celia didn't just applaud Fidel Castro.
From the first moment he appeared on the scene, she idolized him as not just my political leader, but also my man.
As Hugo Matos describes it now, almost 60 years after the event, Celia Sanchez was already under the spell of Fidel Castro, although she wouldn't actually meet him for nearly 4 years. In 1955, Castro was released and went into exile in Mexico. Meanwhile, Celia Sanchez coordinated her own operations against Batista and apparently even planned to attack him with explosives. But it was her groundwork that would be critical when the Granma, a leaky vessel with 82 rebels on board, arrived from Mexico in December 1956. Former Cuban insider, Domingo Amuchastegui again.
She was responsible for building much of the infrastructure in terms of support, connections, recruiting of entire peasants' family to be ready to receive and support the landing of Fidel Castro in 1956. That is fundamental for explaining the survival and quick recovery of the guerrilla after the disastrous landing.
And if it hadn't been for that support, would Fidel Castro and the others who survived, would they have made it to the Sierra Maestra?
Very difficult to imagine, yes. It would be fair to say that.
In my house in Yara, we all belong to the 26th of July movement. Because of the killings, the attacks on our community, two young women were raped by the local National Guard. We all felt outraged.
Brigadier General Tete Puebla, the highest-ranking woman in Cuba's Revolutionary Armed Forces, was just 15 years old and from Yara in Oriente when she joined the rebels.
We took part in an armed assault against Batista's troops, but were betrayed. That's when we decided to join Fidel Castro in the Sierra.
Tell me about the first time that you met Celia.
Yo conocí a Celia en el año 57.
I met Celia in 1957, while I was still really just a girl. And from that moment on, I was her assistant. Often, those who joined the rebels couldn't read or write. And Celia would say, "Come on, Tete." So we'd read them their letters, and she'd write letters for them to their families. And that's the first job Celia and I did together up in Sierra Maestra.
Okay, well, for 3 kilometers, it's a muddy, rocky scramble up to La Comandancia, La Plata. And then suddenly it opens out. You get these supreme views right across the Sierra Maestra. The slopes here are still blanketed in tropical vegetation. And if you strain your ears, you can just hear the stream that runs close by. Just ahead lies La Comandancia La Plata, the last headquarters of the rebels. And it was here that Celia and Fidel lived during 1958. Aldo Naranjo Tamayo has guided me up here this morning. So Aldo, tell me something about the gardens that Celia constructed here.
Celia Sanchez.
He says that in this special place where the battle occurs, where the aviation attacks, Celia planted flowers, plants, and of course the orchids that she loves very much.
Se me queda una flor especial. Que también está aquí en la comandancia.
Also, Celia loved the white butterfly. It's a Cuban national flower. It was not used only to place it on the hair. It was also used to hide the messages.
So they would hide the messages in the flowers?
In the flower.
Yeah. I've seen pictures of Celia with this white flower of Cuba in her hair.
Hay mucha pintura de Celia que recrean.
There are many paintings of Celia where you can see the butterfly flowered in her hair.
Más arriba, aquí estaba Radio Rebelde.
Aquí Radio Rebelde desde un punto de la Sierra Maestra en el territorio libre de Cuba.
While Radio Rebelde blasted from the mountains, Celia, with her highly developed organizational skills, had oversight of food, clothes, arms, everything the rebels needed in the Sierra. And together with Tete Puebla, one of the women who belonged to Cuba's first all-women combat platoon, the Marianas, she went into battle against Batista's troops.
The first battle where Celia took part was Ubero.
It was really tough. Batista's guards dominated much of the Sierra. They bombed and killed many peasants. Celia was in control of some of those areas, where sometimes 40 or 50 people died. And along with all the other responsibilities she had, Celia took care of those families.
Now we're just coming down to what was Casa de Fidel, Fidel's house. So what it is, it's a very plain wooden hut. It's got a very small veranda.
Here we can see a refrigerator that was brought by horse.
I mean, that's what strikes you when you come up here. Everything's hewn from wood, and then you see this enormous grate. It looks like an American fridge right in the middle of the room, huh?
Yes.
This is very, very well hidden, Aldo.
The planes cannot see it because of the trees and the environment. This is the bedroom of Fidel, but very rarely he used the bed because he loved the hammock.
Now, what about Celia? Because I read that Celia stayed here as well.
She used to live here with another group of women, and they slept in hammocks in the other room.
And Aldo, what can you tell me about the relationship between Fidel and Celia? Do you think they were lovers?
No. He
says that they were not lovers. The relationship between Celia and Fidel was always a relationship between two fighters that have the same ideals and thoughts.
It always felt rude asking the question, but this is the kind of answer I got in Cuba from most people I spoke to who knew Celia Sanchez. Others said they simply didn't know. Hugo Matos, now in exile, tells a different story.
I went to Costa Rica to look for arms to take to the Sierra. When I returned in 1958, there was Celia Sanchez beside Fidel Castro, and I realized their relationship wasn't just political, but intimate, too.
So why, I asked him, did everyone else say this wasn't the case?
I saw what others didn't see. I was in a privileged position. I was a very good friend of Celia's, and I was one of Fidel Castro's commanders. They hid it in public because Fidel has always managed his relationships like he's a professional actor. All his life he's been like an actor in a film or the theatre.
It's true even today, Cubans know little about the private life of their former president. And neither Fidel Castro nor Celia Sanchez, when she was alive, addressed the nature of their relationship. And, many would say, why would they? But Cuban history, as I said, is a bloody battleground. The historian Tiffany Sapil believes the absence of testimony from Fidel or Celia allows both the loyalists and the anti-Castro faction to construct their own versions of what's universally agreed was a key relationship.
On the Cuban side, to say, you know, well, maybe, but maybe not, allows everyone to play up that they were solely focused on the revolutionary project. It preserves her for the Cuban people to place whatever meanings they need on her. The Miami version of Celia Sanchez is that she was controlling, you know, that she was somehow like a puppeteer or manipulative, and also I think playing up the sexual relationship between Castro and Celia. For Miami, it's a way to break down the sanctity maybe of their political commitment by saying that, oh, well, really behind closed doors, it was a sexual relationship.
So sex dilutes politics. Domingo Amuchastegui has this analysis of the power of the Celia-Fidel story and the way that it plays in the exile community.
Miami is a very special place. You can find here all kinds of fantasies, storytelling. This is how Miami works, the Cuban Miami, that is. And they are stuck with a number of stereotypes, and that's one of their favorite stereotypes.
That Celia was Fidel's lover, that she was controlling, that she was as evil as him.
Yeah. This is a place where you have a generation of Cubans who were defeated in 1959, were defeated in 1961, were defeated in 1962, and they don't know how to explain their own defeats.
In January 1959, with a rebel's triumphant entry into Havana, the only defeat being thought about by the vast majority of Cubans was that of Fulgencio Batista. These were heady days. But the execution by firing squad of Batista's associates took the shine off the revolution for some, and the move towards the political left worried others. Hugo Matos denounced communist influence and resigned from the government. By the end of 1959, he was in jail, where he'd stay for 2 decades. He told me how he thinks Celia Sanchez might have influenced the outcome of his case.
I imagine that Celia would have said something to Fidel with respect to Hugo Matos. But she was in love with Fidel from the time they were in the Sierra Maestra, so the esteem she might have felt for Hugo Matos came in second or third place. I imagine that she would have tried to influence Fidel so that I wasn't shot. It's possible, but it's just a supposition. I don't have any evidence.
Now nearly 40 years old, in the new Cuba, Celia Sanchez was a linchpin of the government. Never far from Fidel, she had an enormous capacity for work bolstered by endless cups of coffee and Chesterfield cigarettes. When she wasn't busy with the chaotic affairs of the new state, she began to work on the historical archive of the revolution and employed Nidia Sarabia.
Throughout the whole revolutionary process, she kept all the paperwork. She guarded it all, even when they were bombarded with napalm. She had this concept that even a small piece of paper from one rebel soldier had a vital importance. I think this was one of the most important and dearly held ideas Celia had, and no one else thought of it. Maybe Fidel did, but nobody else in the leadership thought we should keep those papers.
Everyone told me how Celia Sanchez always maintained her connections with her beloved Oriente and its people. She made sure the families in the Sierra Maestra were well looked after, especially the children. I met Eugenia Palomares in Havana. Eugenia was born in a cave during a battle in the Sierra. Her father, a rebel soldier, had already been killed. Soon after Fidel Castro came to power, her mother died and she was brought up by her grandparents. Then, in the early 1960s, Celia Sanchez sent for her to come to Havana.
My grandfather said, when you get to Havana, you're going to meet a really skinny woman. Ask her for her blessing, because that's your godmother. And in her house, you're going to see a tall man with fine hands and a beard. He's your godfather, so ask him for his blessing too. That's Fidel.
Eugenia lived with Celia Sanchez for 15 years and provides a tantalizing window on Celia's domestic setup.
Life in that apartment was normal, like anywhere else. We had a ration book and clothing coupons. I went to school. And at night, Celia would ask, "What did you learn today?" She was always working in her office on the next floor. She didn't go to bed till 5 or 6 in the morning. When the comandante, Fidel, was on his way, the code words were,